Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. We got 2 hours of open forum for you today where anybody can call with any question. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. Second hour, Mark Brumley will be here with us. First hour, it's Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Cy Kelly.
Have you gotten used to doing this show later yet? Or is it still weird?
No, it's not too weird. Not anymore. I'm getting used to, because for me, since I'm now in the central time zone, hour one is 5 p.m. and hour two is 6 p.m. for me, as opposed to 3 and 4 p.m. when I was living in California.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a little different. You know, it's like, okay, I get to the end of the workday and then I got to work some more. But I'm getting used to it.
Well, we're glad you're here. Open forum, that means you can ask Jimmy whatever you like, 888-318-7884. Okay, this is a Thursday. We've had you on different days of the week recently, but it is a Thursday, so I can ask, what's dropping tomorrow on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
It's our fifth anniversary. Technically, today is our fifth anniversary, but since tomorrow's Friday, we're celebrating it with a special episode where, you know, our audience is more than 100,000 listeners now, and so I invited them to send in their mysterious experiences, and boy, did they. They sent in video and audio files and emails, and when I put the emails alone into a Word document, it was 80 pages single-spaced. So I am saving some of the experiences for the future, but I took a selection of them and made an episode out of them where we let folks present what it was that happened to them, what was their experience, and then I offer a few thoughts. Like, if this was a conventional experience, here are some things that might explain it, but if it's an unconventional experience, you know, a paranormal or supernatural one, here's the category it would go in, and things like that.
All right, cool. So tomorrow, get the new episode, the fifth anniversary episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. If you want to check it out, just go to mysterious.fm, mysterious.fm. If you want to talk with Jimmy now, just call 888-318-7884. Let me look. I haven't even looked at the phones yet. Oh, there's lines open. We got lines open, which is unusual on a Thursday when Jimmy's here. So, yeah, pick up that phone.
We are only 3 minutes in, so.
I know, but I'm a little spoiled with you, Jimmy, because usually the lines are full by now. Usually the calls start before you get on the air.
Like one of them did.
Edgar, let's go to him. Greg in Santa Clarita, California, watching on YouTube. Glad you're here, Greg. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy. My computer will not work. Will you put line one on for me? Greg, you there with us?
I am here.
All right. Yeah, we got you now. Go ahead with your question.
Okay, perfect. So, hey, Jimmy, my question is this. Revision number 2267 of the Catechism regarding the death penalty, why was it changed? What does it really mean pragmatically? And should anyone even care?
Okay, so we got three questions there. The first one, why was it changed? And the basic answer to that is, well, there's been a shift in recent decades on the part of popes regarding the, and others in the magisterium, but particularly on the part of popes regarding the application of the death penalty. Traditionally, it has been regarded, the use of capital punishment has been regarded as legitimate, both for purposes of administering justice to the offender and for purposes of protecting society from future offenses. Grave offenses against life, you know, like putting a murderer to death so he can't murder anybody else. Well, that's the traditional position. And in the time of John Paul II, when the first edition of the Catechism was released in 1992, there was already this shift underway. And that's actually something you can observe in the text of paragraph 2267 in the 1992 edition of the Catechism, because it says that one of the conditions that needs to be met for capital punishment to be legitimate is it can only be applied if this is the only possible way to protect human life against an unjust aggressor. So what that does is it omits the earlier and excludes the earlier allowance of capital punishment in the case for purposes of administering justice. You know, so you killed someone, now you need to die in justice. It's not simply for purposes of protecting society. It was also for purposes of justice. And now that's gone in the 1992 version of the Catechism. Subsequently, there was continuing discussion of this, and by the time of Pope Francis, he wanted to eliminate even any application of capital punishment. And so he had the Catechism altered to say that the death penalty is not admissible. And exactly what that means is unclear. The Magisterium hasn't really offered an explanation of what that means, which, to be frank, is not that typical, not that untypical of the way the Magisterium operates. Often it will make a decision and it will announce a teaching, and then it will leave it up to theologians to provide a rationale for the teaching and to make sense of it. You often have magisterial decisions where, you know, the Magisterium wants to move in a certain direction, but they don't want to overcommit themselves to a particular rationale for it. And so they'll leave it up to others to try to figure out the exact parameters of the new position and what the reasons for the new position are. And that's essentially what's happened in this case. So that's the answer to your first question. You know, why has this happened? Well, there's been this ongoing movement in the Magisterium, and particularly among the popes, to want to restrict the use of capital punishment. I should mention there was also another intermediate step in there where, even after the Catechism was released in 1992, Pope John Paul II issued an encyclical called Evangelium Vitae on the subject of human life. And one of the things that got modified there was, even though he didn't say there are no situations where capital punishment could be applied, John Paul II questioned whether there are any remaining situations where it could be applied under the new criterion, given the ability of modern states to imprison people for life, for example. So that's the basic answer to why it's changed. Your second question was, what practical difference does it make? Well, if one is taking the Catechism's position seriously, then that would mean you can't ever apply capital punishment today. It's inadmissible. You can, again, question what that would mean and why is it inadmissible. But bottom line, if you're taking the Catechism's position seriously, then you shouldn't be applying capital punishment. On the other hand, if you're not taking the Catechism's position seriously, then it's not really going to make much of a practical difference for you. In terms of should anybody care, your third question, well, human life is an important issue. And so one should definitely care about this subject, regardless of whether one agrees or disagrees with the Catechism's position. It's dealing with an important issue, even though in the developed world, capital punishment is quite rare. It is important to have a clear understanding of the principles under which life can be taken. And so one should care about this issue for that reason, regardless of the position one takes.
Greg, I'm going to say thanks and leave it there because it's time for our first break. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
This is Father John Trigilio. We need Catholic Radio because it is a lifeline to Holy Mother Church. Catholic Radio enables us to know what the Church teaches, but also to have solidarity with one another. It is one way that we express our commonality, our communio, that we are family, and by staying together, we can be God's children here on earth.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's exactly 6 weeks until we kick off the 9th annual Catholic Answers Apologetics Conference. And man, are we excited. Conference time is the best time of the year. If you've never been, you need to come. And if you've come in the past, chances are you are coming back. Please accept our personal invitation to the conference in September. It's the theme is I Believe in God. We have wonderful guests, including Dr. Scott Hahn and Sister Regina Marie Gorman. And all of our apologists will be there. CatholicAnswersConference.com is the place to go to make your reservation. CatholicAnswersConference.com. It's open forum this hour and next here on Catholic Answers. Your call, your question is very welcome, whether you're Catholic or not. 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. John in Oklahoma up next. John, thank you very much for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Jimmy, one of the most troubling things that I've seen, perhaps in my life, was the incident with the Pachamama statue in the Vatican Gardens, where there appeared to be worship offered to that wooden, you know, idol or statue, whatever you wish to call it, in the presence of the Pope and cardinals. I've never heard an adequate or even a basic defense of that. Do you have any idea what their justification for that kind of thing was? Thank you.
Yeah, I do. And I have to say, I understand your concern here, because the optics of the incident, the way they were portrayed, especially in certain parts of Catholic media, including by various internet Catholics who ought to know better but have some hostility towards the current pontificate and who are not following the catechisms and, frankly, the moral law as a requirement to give things a favorable interpretation and seeking to understand them from the perspective of the people who were involved in an action and what they were doing and trying to do and what they were not trying to do. They just hauled off and said, this is an idol and these people are worshiping it. And they misled a bunch of people into thinking that was the case. But that was not the case. The statue, it was, because it was not an idol, even though you could hear other Catholic people say it was, that really was not well grounded. What it was a symbol of Mother Earth. In the local languages down there, Pachamama means Mother Earth. And Mother Earth is a personification of the planet we live on. We use Mother Earth even in English. You know, if you watch, I think it's Charlotte's Web, they even have a song in there about Mother Earth and Father Time. And so Mother Earth is a common way of personifying the world we live in. And there's nothing wrong with personifying the earth. In fact, you find various personifications of things in nature or things about the world, sometimes even abstract ones like wisdom, in the Old Testament itself. So you find biblical personifications that are not understood as deities and that are not understood to be literally true. This is just a symbol of something else. So for example, in the book of Proverbs, wisdom is personified as a woman who is, of course, a wise woman, but it's not like there's a goddess named Wisdom and having texts in Proverbs praising wisdom does not mean you're praising a goddess of wisdom. And it doesn't mean that this wisdom is a literal being. It's just wisdom is an abstract quality that happens to be personified. And in the same way, picturing the earth as if it's a woman, which is what happened in this case, is not meant to be taken literally. It doesn't mean it's a deity or things like that. Now, that doesn't mean that nobody worships a deity that's a personification of the world. In fact, you know, there are. In Egyptian mythology, for example, the earth is depicted as a god named Geb, and the sky, his wife, is depicted as a goddess named Nut. And so there are people who would personify the earth and worship it as a deity. The Egyptians did that. They worshiped Geb. And there were some people, and have been some tribal people down in South America, who have worshiped Mother Earth. And of course, they use the name Mother Earth for that. You know, they'd say Pachamama. So there were people who would worship Pachamama as a goddess, but they weren't Catholics. And it, in fact, the image that they have, which is of Mother Earth as a pregnant woman, symbolizing the fecundity of the earth, its ability to nurture new life, That's not a traditional Pachamama image. This is not something, you didn't have similar images of a pregnant kneeling woman being worshipped by people down in the rainforest. This was something new they came up with for the conference that they had in Rome. And so this is a brand new symbol. It's just a way of personifying the earth that God has given to us and that we need to take care for. And they took this symbol over to Rome for this meeting, and then people, you know, prayed around it and had ceremonies, you know, but they weren't worshiping the image. And just like you can praise wisdom without literally worshiping wisdom as a goddess, you can give thanks to God for Mother Earth and you know, symbolically say thanks for the blessings that are in our lives, because we get to live on Earth and we have food and we have this wonderful nature around us that God has created. You can do all of that without thinking something's literally a goddess. And as long as you're not thinking this is a goddess, you're not committing idolatry. So this was very widely misrepresented in certain discontented parts of the Catholic blogosphere, and misrepresented as if it's idolatry, when if you try to understand what actually happened here and how this statuette got made and what it actually represented and what people were actually doing, they were not worshiping as a goddess. These people are Catholics. They know there's only one God. That doesn't mean you can't show respect or reverence for other things, like, for example, the saints, and, or wisdom or things like that. And so I understand the concern, but I would have to say that this incident was very widely misrepresented by people who ought to know better and who ought to be more charitable than they in fact were. Having said that, I agree the optics of it lent themselves to misunderstanding. And so if they had asked me, should we do this? Should we make this statue and bring it over and put it in an area where people are praying to God and singing songs to God and stuff like that, most of which will not be understood because we don't all speak the same language, I would say, no, you shouldn't do that. That's going to cause some confusion. But it is not actually idolatry.
John, thank you very, very much for that question. It's a while since we've had a Pachamama question, and I appreciate it. Let's go to Dallas, Texas. Binto is listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. Binto, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy.
Howdy.
My question is on the way we call Jesus and Mother Mary, the names Jesus and Mary, mm-hmm. In English. But if you look at the original language, or even in many Eastern rites, it's called as, you know, Jesus is called as Yeshu, or Mother Mary is named as Mariam. So I was wondering how that changes happen. For example, I mean, if you go to Germany or Japan or anywhere in Africa, your name will still be Jimmy, right? They won't change the name based on the language. So that was my first question as to why the name change happened in language. The second is, should we go back to, you know, referring Jesus and Mary with their original names? Because these names, biblical names, do have a meaning, right?
Okay, so the reason that, first of all, the reason that that these name changes occurred is because names get modified. That happens even within a single language. For example, my legal name is Jimmy. That's what's on my birth certificate. But that doesn't stop some people from referring to me as James. It also doesn't stop some people from referring to me as Jim. So right there, even though my legal name is Jimmy, some people, even in English, call me by other names. The same thing happens when you start crossing languages, because languages either do or don't have equivalents in other languages, and whether or not they have an equivalent in another language, they frequently get modified to sound more natural in the other language. So, for example, in Spanish, you could call me Jaime, or you could call me Diego. And if I'm down in Mexico or somewhere else in the Spanish-speaking world and someone refers to me as Jaime or Diego, I'm not going to have a problem with that. Similarly, if I was in Scotland my name, or at least one of my names historically, would be Hamish, because Hamish is the Scottish equivalent of James. Similarly, in Ireland, I would be called Seamus, because Seamus is the Irish equivalent of James. And I actually had a friend from Northern Ireland who would refer to me as Seamus. It was just what he called me. In Hebrew, my name would be Yaqub. And so if I went over to Israel, someone is a native Hebrew speaker in Israel might refer to me as Yaqub. And if I went over to the Vatican and they wanted to refer to me by my Latin name, it would be Jacobus. And so there are a bunch of variations right there on my name, Jimmy. And I don't have a problem with that. I don't think that people must call me Jimmy. If they call me James, I'll often correct them because that's actually not my legal name. But I would let all the others slide. You know, I actually kind of like it if my Irish friend calls me Seamus, for example. And Jim is so close to Jimmy, I generally don't bother insisting on the extra syllable. So actually, I got a lot of variations on my name. And the same is true of names like Jesus and Mary. Now, so we get the name Jesus from the Greek Jesus, which is what his name is in Greek. And that's what's in the Greek New Testament. Similarly, Maria and Mariam are both just variations on Mary, and they both appear in the Greek New Testament. So if you want to call Jesus and Mary by their names in the New Testament, it's Jesus and either Maria or Mariam. But we know that they weren't native Greek speakers. They may have spoken Greek, but they were natively Aramaic speakers. And so their names would have been a little different, particularly Jesus's. But then you've got a question of, so if we wanted to call Jesus by his Aramaic name, which version of Aramaic are you going to use? Because it's kind of like in English with Jim and Jimmy. They're not identical names. Jamie is another variation that's in English. They're not identical names, but they're used by different groups of English speakers. So different Aramaic speakers have different names for Jesus too. It is often conjectured that his Aramaic name would be pronounced Yeshua, but there are other dialects of Aramaic where the name Jesus is pronounced Yeshua. And so even in Aramaic, Jesus could be called different things depending on which dialect of Aramaic you're speaking. And while, yes, names do have meanings, and that's why the New Testament points out that Jesus has the name he has because he's going to save his people from his sins, Yeshua means something like God saves or Yahweh saves. That doesn't mean you got to use the name in its pristine form. It was not used in its pristine form even in Jesus's own day. And I think we have proof of the fact that Jesus and Mary don't really care about us using the pristine forms of their names because the inspired New Testament doesn't use them. Jesus, like I said, he gets called Jesus in the New Testament and not Yeshua or Yeshua or things like that. So he and his Holy Spirit inspired the New Testament to use this Greek version, and that shows that he's not really hung up about us calling him by the exact Aramaic name, the exact way it was pronounced in his hometown Aramaic dialect. So I don't think we need to sweat this one.
Binto, thank you very, very much. I'm going to keep moving, try to get as many on with Jimmy as I can. Ken's in Texas, listening on 106.9 FM. Ken, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Howdy and hello. Hey, I got questions about, like, the crosses on the side of the road where people have died. What's the Catholic view on that? Can we pray in front of them just like we do in the cemetery? I know if we pray at the cemetery, there's an indulgence or two associated with that. Is there a same indulgence if we pray at a cross of someplace that died? Catholics put the cross at a place?
I'm going to need to start answering these questions because we're about to hit the break. The Catholic Church does not have a teaching about roadside crosses. However, there doesn't seem to be anything objectionable in principle. So if you want to put up a memorial for a relative who died in, say, a traffic accident by the site where they died on the road, there's nothing wrong with that. You can do that. Can you pray at them? Well, I do. When I drive past them, I'll say, Lord, help this person, you know. But if you want to stop and pray, you can. Just be sure you park safely so that you don't get hit by a passing car. There's nothing wrong with praying for people. You can do it in any location, including at a site of a monument commemorating their memory. Is there an indulgence for praying at roadside crosses? That's one I don't know the answer to. I'm pretty sure there's not a specific indulgence for that. But I'd have to look in the Enchiridion or Handbook of Indulgences to see what kind of indulgence is available of it for this. I would guess there's probably one for praying for someone, for the soul of someone, regardless of where you're located. But I'd have to check specifically to see the wording and whether it would apply to a roadside cross monument.
And that brings us to the break. Thanks, Ken, very much for the question. We'll take a quick break, right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
What if the voice of your deepest doubts about Catholicism rose up in the form of a human being and challenged you to defend your most foundational beliefs? That's the task apologist Trent Horn took upon himself in his new book, Devil's Advocate, a dialogue with his own best objections against the faith that he professes and defends. You can stand up against your doubts, and Trent will show you how. Pick up your copy of Devil's Advocate today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
This is Dr. David Anders. Are your friends or family discouraging you from becoming Catholic?
We can help on Call to Communion tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live, a little bit of groovy music. Jimmy Akin here. Next hour, Mark Brumley will be here. And it's open forum. You can call and ask whatever you like. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. We go right to Janet, who's in Maryland, listening on 1160 AM. Janet, welcome. Go ahead with your question.
Good evening, Jimmy, and good evening, Asai.
Good evening, Janet.
My question to you is, I was in conversation. I have a very good non-denominational Christian friend, and I'm a cradle Catholic. And as we were talking, their belief is that Our Lady, Our Blessed Mother, realized the divinity and started following Jesus at the very end of the time of his death, just, you know, at the very end, which kind of left me dumbfounded, and I kind of was taken aback being a cradle Catholic, because I know that's not true. How would you answer that? Because I know Our Lady was submissive in her fiat in Luke 1. But how would you answer that to someone that's non-Catholic and the belief is completely opposite of what we believe.
Okay, Janet.
Okay, so Janet, let me ask you a question. What are you asking exactly? Are you asking about when did Mary consent to become the mother of the Messiah, or when did Mary consent to having a son who would cause her suffering, you know, like through his death on the cross? Or are you asking specifically the question, when did Mary realize that Jesus was God?
No, my non-denominational friend realizes that the Blessed Mother realized his divinity only at the time of his death.
No, I understand that. I'm asking, what are you asking? What is your question?
My question is, how would I answer that? I was kind of trying to, mm-hmm. you know, talk to her about it. And how would you, as apologetic, how would you, you know, what advice would you give me and how I could answer that question?
Well, you said that we Catholics don't believe that Mary only realized that Jesus was divine towards the end of his life. I would ask, how do you know that? What would you appeal to show that Catholics need to believe that? Because I can, let me simplify it for you, because I can make a counter case. Now, when Gabriel shows up and tells Mary that she's going to be the mother of the Messiah, he says, therefore, the child that will be born to you will be called the Son of God. So, okay, Mary knows from before conception that Jesus is going to be the Son of God. The difficulty is the term Son of God can mean multiple different things. It can refer to what we mean today, which is he's the second person of the divine Trinity. It can, but that was a new meaning. That was not something Jewish people were expecting. They didn't have a clear understanding that there is a Son of God in that sense. There were some indications that some Jews understood there to be some kind of plurality in the Godhead. So like there's maybe more than one person there, but they didn't have a revelation of the second person is regarded as the son of the first person who is the Father. So they didn't have a clear understanding of that point. They did have another tradition, which was to refer to certain high-ranking angels as sons of God. And that's a usage that's found in various passages in the Old Testament. They also had a tradition of regarding the king as the Son of God. You know, so like we read in the Psalms, you are my son, today I have begotten you, where God is addressing the king of Israel. They also had a recognition of Adam as the Son of God, because if you look at Luke's genealogy in Luke chapter 3, Luke traces Jesus's genealogy all the way back to Adam, and then he says, and Adam was the Son of God. So there's a sense in which Adam is the Son of God, even though he's not the second person of the Trinity. They also had the idea that righteous people are sons of God. And so they had multiple different understandings of what the phrase Son of God meant, none of which were our modern clear understanding of second person of the divine Trinity, who is eternally begotten by the first person of the divine Trinity. So that was a new usage. So if you put yourself in Mary's position and say, how do you understand this statement that she's going to give birth to the Messiah and he's going to be called the Son of God? Well, he could be called a Son of God in several of those senses. In particular, since the Messiah is the rightful king of Israel as the successor to the line of David, he could be the Son of God in the same sense that the Israelite kings were. And that wouldn't imply he was a divine person in the same way. So that actually would be more likely how Mary might understand it. And we seem to have confirmation that Mary did not initially understand the full reality of the kind of Son of God that Jesus was. Because if in Luke, at the end of Luke chapter 2, Jesus is 12 years old, he's been left in the temple, they go to find him, and when they finally discover him in the temple, Mary says, why have you done this? Because your father and I have been anxiously looking for you. And Jesus's reply is, did you not know that I would need to be in my father's house? And so he's implying, well, look, I'm the Son of God in such a unique sense that I'm going to go to the temple and I'm going to be in my father's house, and that's where you should have started looking for me. But she obviously didn't understand that. Otherwise, they would have started by looking for Jesus in the temple. So it seems that Mary, even when Jesus is 12 years old, does not have a clear understanding of the full reality of what it means for him to be the Son of God. She understands he's the Son of God in some sense, but it doesn't seem clear, she doesn't seem to be fully clear on exactly what sense he's the Son of God in. She hasn't locked in on the full modern understanding yet. And that would suggest that she came to this understanding sometime after Jesus was 12 years old. But when? Well, we don't have a anything in the Gospels that would identify that moment precisely for us. And in fact, in the Gospels, there's some contention between Jesus and his family, including Mary, where it seems they don't fully understand his mission. You know, that happens in all three of the Synoptic Gospels, for example. And it's mentioned that Mary is one of the family members who comes to talk to him about his mission, which they don't fully understand. So I would say if someone told me it was only at the end of Jesus's life that Mary had a full understanding of who he was, I'd say, well, okay, that's an interesting proposal. Maybe you're right and maybe you're not. I would like to know how you know it was just at that last moment rather than earlier, because I could see it being earlier than that. But I also can't rule out, based on the biblical data, that it was late in the game when she came to a final, full understanding of exactly what his sonship means. So that's how I'd approach the question. And so regardless of whether one says, oh, she knew early, or no, she didn't know until the last minute, I would say, well, what's your basis for this view? Because I'm not aware of any teaching of the Catholic Church that says Mary had to understand all this early. In fact, the Second Vatican Council document Lumen Gentium acknowledges that there were things that Mary did not initially understand about Jesus and that she grew into an understanding of. And so I don't think we have a church teaching on exactly when she understood this point. And I would say, based on the data, one could hold a variety of different positions.
Janet, I wonder, how does that all sit with you?
Yeah, I think that sounds great. I wanted to ask Jimmy, like, as a beginner apologist, it's very interesting to me. What does he suggest I should read and, you know, or resources that I could have?
Okay.
Those questions are...
Yeah.
Yeah. So I have two basic suggestions. The first one is go to schoolofapologetics.com, and that's our online Catholic School of Apologetics. And you might want to check out a course that I taught called Beginning Apologetics. And you can watch it online. It's just short segments. You can watch it at your own pace. And so I'd suggest that. I'd also suggest you get a copy of my book, A Daily Defense, which goes through more than 300 different defenses of the Catholic faith and the Christian faith more broadly, and faith in general, even more broadly than that. And since you're here in the United States, Janet, let's see if you can hang on the line and we'll send you a copy of A Daily Defense.
Janet, we're going to go to a break, so please do hang on the line. Edgar will get to you. And if you'd like a copy of A Daily Defense, all you got to do is give us an address and we'll send it off. Right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
EWTN's religious catalog has great summer reading for kids. ABC Get to Know the Saints with Me introduces young readers to the communion of saints in a simple and memorable way. Each page includes an easy-to-read letter of the alphabet and a charming rhyme about the life of the corresponding saint in heaven. For more, visit EWTNRC.com today.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press, will be here next hour. So any call is welcome for Mark, but maybe you've got a question about the Ignatius Study Bible. Every time he's on, people ask me about the Ignatius Study Bible. So you can call him and ask him that if you'd like.
Good. They need to pester him about that.
That's what everybody says. Will you pester Mark about this? And I have neglected to pester, so today I'm going to pester Mark. I hope he's ready for it. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour, the number 888-31-TRUTH. Off we go to New York, where Kevin is listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Kevin, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
I hope you're doing fine. So I was wondering, what is the official, I guess, Council of Trent or Catholic view of total depravity? Because I'd say, in a sense, well, we reject, you know, Calvinism. But, you know, I've heard my friend who's a Thomist say that God always makes the first move, and repentance is in itself a grace from God, which sounds like total depravity, that we cannot choose God, you know, without
right.
him
gotcha.
First calling
so,
us.
So the answer is going to depend on – so total depravity is a doctrine that's discussed in Calvinism, and it's understood different ways. Based on the name total depravity, it makes it sound like humans are as depraved as possible. They're just totally depraved, and that makes it sound like they're as sinful as possible. So like every single minute you're alive, you're mortally sinning in the worst way. And based on the name total depravity, that's how some folks in Calvinism understand it, that like we're constantly mortally sinning every single moment. And we're all just as bad as Hitler. You break the law at all, you're just as bad as Hitler. There are people who have that view, but they tend to be lay people. They tend not to be Calvinist theologians. Calvinist theologians tend to have a more refined view of what total depravity means, and some of them prefer alternative terminology, even though total depravity is the term that's been used historically in English. At least many of them recognize this is a misleading term. It misleads people into thinking something much worse than is actually the case. And so, for example, the one of the alternative proposals is to total depravity is total inability. And total inability is understood as total inability to turn to God without his grace. And so this is then the idea that in order to turn to God and repent, we need God's grace. God must take the initiative and give us his grace first to make that conversion possible. We can't do it by ourselves without grace. And if that's what you mean, if you mean totally unable to come to God without his grace, Catholics would agree with that. That, in fact, that's actual Catholic teaching. So if that's what you mean by total depravity, Catholics would be right there with you. But the term total depravity is kind of misleading. If you'd like to read more about this, I wrote a paper a number of years ago exploring how close one could get to Calvinism without violating Catholic teaching. I've always meant to write a counterpaper of how far away you could get from Calvinism, but without violating Catholic teaching, but I haven't done that. I need to do that at some point to balance it. But if you want to read this paper, it's on my website, jimmyakin.com. It's called A Tiptoe Through Tulip, T-U-L-I-P, the famous Calvinistic acronym for their five distinctive doctrines. So look up A Tiptoe Through Tulip by Jimmy Akin.
And thank you very, very much, Kevin, for the call. Appreciate it. I'm going to keep moving, try to get on as many as I can with Jimmy. And up next is Eva in Phoenix watching on YouTube. Eva, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello, Jimmy. Hello, everybody. I'm actually calling on behalf of my cousin who's in the UK, and she's unable to call into
That's
the line.
That's okay.
So
what's your question?
Thank you. Her question is, as a Catholic, is it okay to do yoga for circulation but not as a spiritual path?
Yeah, well, if you're just assuming yoga postures, they're like any other postures you might assume. Postures do not have intrinsic meaning. They only have the meanings we give to them. like, for example, and this is one reason why some gestures are offensive in some cultures but not others, because the local people give different meanings to them. And in some cultures, a friendly gesture gets interpreted in an unfriendly way, and vice versa. Well, the same is true not just of what we do with our hands or our tongues, because that's where speech comes from. We put our mouth in different postures to make words, and they get understood differently in different cultures. Well, the same thing is true of our overall body. And so bodily postures don't have an intrinsic meaning. If you're not layering on a spiritual meaning, then you're just doing an exercise. And as long as you're doing an exercise, whether they call it yoga or something else, and you're not attributing any religious significance to this, and you're not endorsing any false teachings by doing this, and yeah, you can stimulate your circulation with this or any other exercise regimen that will work for you.
Thank you so much.
Eva, thanks.
No problem.
Thanks very much. If your cousin or anybody... go ahead.
And I would also say that you'll hear some folks claim that the contrary to that, but invariably, or almost invariably, I should say, they're being superstitious, and they're attributing more significance to postures than the postures really have. And that's the definition of superstition, is believing too much about something. Like, you believe that these postures have too much meaning compared to the meaning they really have.
Again, Eva, thanks very, very much. Let's go to Catherine in Victoria, Texas, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Catherine, go ahead with your question.
Yeah, this is in light of the whole with Mary not knowing fully about Jesus being God. Mm-hmm. I just want to know what your thoughts are, because I'd heard this in a Credible Witness class also. What about how she conceived? You know, that didn't tell her.
Well, she knew God. She knew that God was going to do a miracle and cause her to have a child. So she knew that. But there have been other miraculous births. Now, there weren't virgin births, but there were other miraculous births in the Old Testament. And God certainly can cause a miraculous birth even without a human father. And that does at least contain, you know, the hint that because there's no human father, it means God is the father. But still, that doesn't tell you in what sense is Jesus the Son of God. God could, to underscore the fact that, let's say, God just wanted a righteous man born. Well, God could miraculously cause a woman to become pregnant without a human father as a way of saying, this is my son, and all he might mean by that is, this is a righteous man. Or if he wants to give birth to have the son be a king, it's like, okay, this is my son, and that means this is a king of Israel. Or, as it turned out, he wants us to understand, this is the second person of the Trinity that I begot eternally, and that's what he meant. And that's, in fact, what Gabriel did mean. The question, though, is not what did Gabriel mean. The question is, what would Mary have understood at this time? And since this was a new and unprecedented use of the phrase Son of God, Mary probably wouldn't have understood it in its full sense at that time. She likely would have understood it in a more narrow sense. And we seem to have evidence, as I covered, for that, because she doesn't seem to fully understand who Jesus is when he's 12 years old, and possibly even later. So I think that, the virgin birth is significant, but I don't think it proves that Mary understood the fullness of who Jesus was when it occurred.
Catherine, thank you very, very much for that follow-up question. I am going to continue moving because lines continue full. Michael's in New York, listening also on the Catholic Answers Live app. Michael, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Okay, so apart from the Gospel of John, which Jesus clearly equates himself with God the Father and God himself, do we have conclusive evidence that in the Synoptic Gospels, Jesus really believed himself to be God?
Yes, I think we do. One of the famous passages that's sometimes cited in this connection in the Synoptic Gospels is where Jesus says that no one knows the Father except the Son, and no one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son and those to whom the Son reveals him. And that suggests an extraordinarily close relationship that is unique between Jesus and the Father. We also have passages in the Synoptic Gospels indicating Jesus's pre-existence, where he talks about having descended from heaven, and that would indicate he previously was in heaven. And then one of the passages I'd point to, and I'll have to be quick about this, I can't explain it fully right now, but there was some awareness in Second Temple era Judaism that there might be some kind of plurality in the Godhead. And this was known, this is known in modern scholarship as the two powers in heaven doctrine, that, okay, there's God up there, that's Yahweh, but then there's also this kind of second Yahweh figure who is also identified as the Son of Man. And when Jesus is asked directly in Mark's gospel, for example, by Caiaphas, the high priest, tell us, you know, plainly, are you the Messiah, the son of the Blessed One? Jesus says, yes, and from now on, you're going to see the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. And that's a reference to Daniel's vision, where Daniel sees God in heaven seated on a throne, and then a cloud comes before him carrying a figure like a Son of Man. This is the apocalyptic figure. It's the second Yahweh figure in the two powers in heaven doctrine. And so by saying from now on you're going to see this, what Jesus is saying is, I'm that guy. I'm the second Yahweh. I'm the second power in heaven. I'm the one in Daniel's vision. I'm the Son of Man. And so I think we do have clear evidence in the Synoptic Gospels that Jesus understood himself to be divine.
Okay, that's a good point. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks very much for the call and for the question. We'll go to Ohio. Jill's in Ohio listening on Annunciation Radio. Jill, glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Happy to.
I just heard this morning on Catechism in a Year, Father Mike Schmitz was defining marriage, and he said it's one baptized man and one baptized woman. And I believe he's going to cover tomorrow what happens if you're Catholic and you marry non-baptized.
Jill, just so you know, we're getting really close to the end of the hour. I need you to ask your question so I can give you a good answer.
Sure thing. So my question is, my husband was not baptized when we were married. Do we need to do... I mean, since then, he has been baptized and converted to Catholicism.
Okay.
Gotcha, Jill.
So, Jill, at the time, assuming y'all got married in the church, assuming you were Catholic, you did not need to do anything. If you got married in the church, it would be a valid marriage, but it would be a natural marriage, not a sacramental marriage. When your husband then got baptized, any marriage between two baptized persons is sacramental. And so when your husband got baptized, your marriage automatically elevated to become a sacramental marriage. As a result, you don't need to do anything, and you should all be fine. The marriage was initially natural, but is now sacramental.
Okay, Jill, we just got a few seconds. Does that all make sense?
Thank you. Appreciate you guys.
Yeah, thank you.
No problem.
Thank you very, very much for the call. I'll tell you what, if you want to hang on, we'll send you a copy of Jimmy's book, A Daily Defense, because we do appreciate that call. And Jimmy, thank you very, very much for those last 2 hours.
No problem, last hour. And,
oh, yeah, that's right.
Have fun in the second hour with Mark Brumley. I know you always say Ignatius Press is the best publisher, Catholic publisher in the Alpha Quadrant. But if you ever look at Star Trek maps, the Alpha Quadrant is set up stupid. Because what they do is they draw a line between the center of the galaxy and the center of our sun that divides the Alpha and Beta Quadrants. And that would mean Earth is in the Alpha Quadrant for 6 months and in the Beta Quadrant for 6 months. And that's a stupid mapping system. But have fun in the Alpha Quadrant nonetheless.
Jimmy, I always learn from you, and it's always these unexpected things. I had no idea about that ridiculous mapping system. That makes no sense at all. All right, I'm going to share that with Mark Brumley and see if he's got a retort. Thanks, Jimmy.
Have fun.
Coming up, more open forum. There's two lines open right now. There'll be another one as soon as we get Jill her book. And if you have a question, you are very, very welcome. You don't have to be Catholic to call. If you've got a question about the Catholic faith, the number is 888-318-7884. Right back with Mark after this on Catholic Answers Live.